This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the battle for regime change is virtually won in Iraq, the United States has to create an interim authority in Iraq and help the country design a new future. It's a good time to look at some of the lessons of the past. The map of the Middle East, as we know it today, was drawn up by the Allies after the First World War, following their defeat of the Ottoman Empire. But the states they created were based more on the needs of the Europeans than on the affinities and loyalties of the people within the Middle East. The borders of Iraq were drawn up by the British, who then ruled Iraq under a mandate from the League of Nations. My guest, David Fromkin, is the author of the book A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. He's a professor of international relations and Middle Eastern politics at Boston University. We're going to hear two interviews with Fromkin. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview we just recorded. But first, we're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview we recorded in 1991, just a few days before the start of the First Gulf War. He told me the concept of nationalism was alien to the Middle East.
The basis of loyalty in the Middle East at the time and for centuries before then had principally been religion. And to the extent that it was not, the basis of loyalty was family, tribe, clan, sect, call it what you will, the locality in which you lived. Middle Easterners had loyalties that were local, except to the extent that they had religious loyalties. There were not nations or countries in the European sense or the American sense of the word, and they hadn't developed a feel for that at that time.
What were the European claims to the Middle East in the teens and the early 1920s? What gave them the authority to redraw the map?
It came about, really, because they won the war. But I think you have to go much, much, much further back. Hundreds of years back to when the Europeans started to explore the globe, Columbus, Vasco da Gama, back to the era of the explorers. And starting at that time, the Europeans conquered or settled every part of the rest of the world. And the Middle East was one of the few areas left, almost the only area left, as of, say, 1914, that the Europeans had not taken in hand, reorganized, and made in their own political image. The Europeans had felt for a long time that someday they would have to take the Middle East in hand, that it was not capable of governing itself. And the moment came when the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire that then ruled the Arab Middle East, recklessly and unnecessarily entered the First World War on Germany's side. And when they did that and then lost the war, that meant that Britain and France were in possession of the Middle East and in a position to determine its future.
Would you give us a quick review of which country drew and controlled which Middle East state?
Syria and what is now Lebanon were controlled by France, who drew their boundaries. And Britain was in occupation of, in control of, what is now Egypt, Israel, West Bank, Jordan, and Iraq, with protectorships over Kuwait and the other Gulf sheikdoms.
Now, how did it end up being Britain and France that took control over these states?
In the First World War, Britain was the Allied power that was most concerned in the fighting in the Middle East. It was Britain that defeated the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire. And at the end of the war in 1918, there was a million-man British army in occupation of the Middle East, and it was the only coherent military force in the entire region. That meant that Britain was in effective control of the entire Middle East.
What did the European countries want from the Middle East? Why did they want the territory?
For different reasons. Both Britain and France wanted control. They were imperialist powers that simply liked controlling a lot of things. British Prime Minister David Lloyd George felt that Britain ought to gain territory and control in the Middle East to compensate Britain for all the losses suffered during the war. Traditionally, Britain had also wanted control of that area, or at any rate wanted to exclude any enemies from control of that area in order to protect Britain's imperial road to India. The French, who were in the Middle East at the same time, in addition to feeling a sense of rivalry with England, had strong commercial and even stronger religious interests in the area as protectors of the Maronite or essentially Roman Catholic population in the canton of Lebanon. So it was a great mix of reasons. Very late in the day, both powers discovered the importance of oil. And it was suspected that oil existed in the Middle East. They didn't know that it existed in the great quantity that we now know that it does, but that was yet one more reason for their being interested in the area. Finally, in Great Britain, there was a strong sentimental interest based on studying the Bible when everyone was children, a very strong sentimental interest in seeing to the fostering of a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
Now, you say that by the time the lines of the map were redrawn and became official in 1922, Europe no longer believed in them.
It was Britain. Britain that had drawn the most lines, had been most responsible for the settlement, didn't. Britain had been changing during the war and after the war. One of the most important events that took place in the first instance had nothing to do with the Middle East. That was the very great economic collapse, the economic downturn in Britain after the war, which made the British voter feel that he didn't have the money or the resources to embark on foreign and imperial adventures, that the money and resources were needed at home to build industry and create jobs. And so for that reason, Britain turned away from the idea of foreign adventures and such. Moreover, there had been a lot of unrest in the Middle East after, and a lot of disorder after the First World War. It was evident that it was becoming evident that it would really take a lot of commitment of resources by Britain to maintain a position there, and the whole thing just started to look much less attractive than it had before. So that there were many in England, not everybody, but there were many in England, certainly in the electorate, in the parliament, in the press, that turned against the arrangements that Britain had made.
Where does the United States fit in to the creation of the modern Middle East?
The United States, too, changed its mind. Under President Woodrow Wilson, who was in office until early 1921, the United States had an idealistic program of trying to ascertain the wishes of the inhabitants of the Middle East as to what form of government they should have. As far as rhetoric was concerned, President Wilson was opposed to the extension of French and British imperialism to the Middle East. America was against imperialism. But Wilson was not effective in his opposition to Britain's plans and France's plans. Once he left office and President Harding took office, America's policy changed dramatically. We were then interested exclusively in the exploitation of oil in the Middle East. That was really our concern, our only concern. And we felt that the exploitation of oil would be facilitated by the creation of stable regimes. And in turn, our idea of a stable regime was the sort of regime that Britain would establish and administer. So we were all in favor of British rule in the Middle East, at least as much as the British were, maybe even more than the British were, under President Harding.
Iraq was a British invention. How were the borders of Iraq created?
There were three provinces of the Ottoman Empire that were put together by the British to form this one country. There were the provinces of Mosul and of Basra and of Baghdad. They were very different provinces, very different in their population makeup. But in dealing with them, the British, for strategic and other reasons, decided to put them together and call them by some common name as a country, and they decided to call them Iraq.
What did Iraq mean?
It means deeply rooted. It means deep in the past, an Arabic word. And that's an appropriate name for Iraq because it's in the territory of Iraq that civilization first came into being. It's a relic of that long ago. It's a relic of Sumer, S-U-M-E-R, ancient civilization, the very first civilization, which rose there in 4000 B.C., roughly.
So what were some of the different religious, tribal, and ethnic groups that were brought together under this new nation of Iraq, groups that never saw themselves as being affiliated in any way before?
Well, in the north, there were the Kurds, a very distinctive people. In the south, there was a very large element of Shia Muslims. They're essentially, they were the largest group in Iraq, as I'll now call it. And then in Baghdad, there were Sunni Muslims of the mainstream of the Muslim religion. And the three of them were quite different. There were also, again in the north, Assyrian Christians. And in the city of Baghdad, the predominant element was the Jewish community.
After World War I, when Britain, France, and Russia carved up the Middle East, was it controversial back home, specifically in England? Did the British voters question the motives of their government? You were saying that the British represented themselves to the Arab people as being patrons of Arab independence, when in fact they really didn't believe in the cause of independence. So did the voters challenge the government's motives? Did the voters believe that this was really about the independence of the Arab people?
Well, they probably did. But newspaper editorials, if there are any indication, did indicate that there was a strong belief that there was no reason for Britain to waste its money trying to foist a regime on Iraq, for example, that the people of Iraq obviously didn't want because they were in a state of revolt.
So it must have put the British government in a complicated situation, because the government that created imperialism in the Middle East was voted out by the time governance there really became an issue, and the new government was voted in by people who were skeptical about this new imperialism.
Yes, and yet England did to some extent maintain a presence in the Middle East, despite that electoral loss, because Winston Churchill, at that time Minister of Colonies, and the person in charge of the government's Middle Eastern policy before the government was defeated, Churchill thought of an economical way to exert British influence in the Middle East, and a way that would not be a financial drain, and therefore that the electorate would allow the government to pursue.
What was
it? It was a combination of using two new weapons, air power and armored cars, in a desert environment, a very effective low-cost combination, military combination, for holding down rebellions and such. Moreover, to make British rule more palatable, so that kind of unrest would no longer take place, Churchill effected a political settlement. The newly created state of Iraq was promised its independence at an early date. An Arab ruler was brought in, sponsored by the British, palatable enough so that the people of the country were willing to accept him. And he immediately started agitating for real independence. And so about 10 years later, Iraq got it. So the imperialist program that Britain was going to impose was very much watered down, but as watered down, proved to be acceptable.
I think most people think of Winston Churchill as having played, you know, a huge part in World War II, but not in post-World War I, not in the post-World War I era. He seems to have been very important in the relationship that England created with Iraq.
He was, and he was very, very important earlier still, as First Lord of the Admiralty, before the First World War broke out. It was he who made sure the fleet was ready when war came. He had a very, very long and very productive political life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is historian David Frumkin. He's the author of the book A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. And this book includes a history of how Iraq was created. What are some of the things that the Brits didn't understand about Islam when they took over Iraq?
The British government had a handful of people, maybe a bit more than a handful, who professed to be experts on the Middle East and on Islam. And these people were not necessarily in agreement with one another. The author of Britain's Middle Eastern policy to begin with was the Minister of War, Lord Kitchener, Britain's most famous soldier, a man with a great national following, and a man who had spent all of his life until then in the Middle East, serving and in India. So he was this great Eastern old hand. Now, he believed, as most of the British did, and possibly rightly, that in the Middle East, the world of the Middle East, religion was everything. The big mistake that he made, and others following him in the British government, was to think that Islam was a structured religion like, for example, Roman Catholicism. And their belief was that there was a person who was like the Pope, one person in charge of this organization, such that if Great Britain, for example, or some other country, could make a deal with that man at the top, they could have the whole organization. So Islam, in that view, was a coherent organization, and you talk to the man at the top, you make your deal with him, and you've got it.
And I guess that didn't take into account that there were different sects within Islam.
And that it is not a structured religion in that way at all.
Well, there are ayatollahs now who seem to rule.
There are ayatollahs who seem to have varying amount of influence and following. But that's different from having one man
right.
who has an organization, and especially a man who can, and I'm deliberately using a slangy kind of phrase, a man with whom you can make a deal.
Right.
As you can with in old-style America, say, of a century ago, the way you could make a deal with a political boss.
Well, an example you give in your book of the type of misunderstanding this led to is that Lord Kitchener's plan called for Ibn Saud, the leader of the Wahhabi sect, and this is the very conservative sect in Saudi Arabia. He was supposed to recognize the spiritual authority of the Sunni ruler of Mecca. And these are different schools of Islam. They don't practice the same. I mean, they have different cultures.
Moreover, the Sunni ruler of Mecca, guardian of the holy places, was not a religious leader. He was, as guardian of the holy places, an emir. He was an appointed official, appointed by the Turkish government to safeguard those holy places. He was a government functionary. He was not a holy man, if you will.
The Brits got a mandate from the League of Nations to control or to run Iraq. What did that mean, to have a mandate from the League of Nations? Yeah.
A great change had taken place in the world and in the public opinion of the various countries on the Allied and enemy side in the war. Sir Mark Sykes, the British bureaucrat in charge of the Middle East, of planning for the post-war Middle East, was a man who had rather good political antennae. He had a feeling for things, and there was a change in the world, and he sensed it sometime in the year 1917. The United States had entered the war on a program opposed to imperialism, and in Russia, two revolutions had taken place. And the Bolsheviks, who had come to power, violently attacked imperialism. So these new forces were anti-imperialist, and everywhere imperialism, which had been a respectable, respected political outlook, was on the defensive. People started to be a bit ashamed of advocating imperialism. And in that environment, the British, the French, and their other allies had to rethink the claims they had staked out for themselves in the post-war Middle East. They had to reconsider how that would go down, even with their own public opinion. And somebody, I say somebody because the historians question which of two or three people thought of it, somebody at the peace conference thought of the idea of a kind of effective compromise. What if you took these territories in the Middle East that Britain, France, and others intended to annex? What if you took them and instead of annexing them and just making them lands you ruled, what if you took them in the form of a trusteeship called a mandate, in which you would come in, yes, you would govern them, but it would be in order to prepare them for eventual independence? That was the mandate system. It was believed in by some and used by others merely as propaganda. The British, I think, genuinely believed that at some point they were going to give independence to the areas over which they had mandates. The French did not. For the French, it was pure and simple propaganda. The French claimed that Syria and Lebanon, which they took as their territories, were going to be part of France, as the French general in charge said, now and forever, end quotes.
So if Britain planned all along to give independence to Iraq after a finite amount of time, what was in it for Britain to have Iraq as a League of Nations mandate, to have it as a protectorate?
Well, there are quite a number of reasons. It should be said, though, at the beginning, that the British, at the start of the mandatory regime, expected to hold Iraq for a very long time. Much longer than, in fact, they held it. So this was going to be something they held for a very long time. Controlling it meant control of the concessions for oil. That was going to be very important. Holding it maintained Britain's strategic position on the road to India. By holding the mandate, Britain could help to mold the country and its consciousness and influence the thinking of young people as they grew up and were educated in British schools, so that in many ways there were great advantages to Britain, and including the negative one that Iraq, during the years of the British mandate, did not side with any of Britain's enemies in the world, so there was no threat from Iraq, and there might well have been, which is something that we know because when the British did, in fact, give up the mandate in the 1930s, at the end of the 1930s, there was an Iraqi regime that seemed disposed to make a deal with Britain's enemies, Nazi Germany and Germany's allies.
When did the rebellions against the British mandate begin in Iraq?
Hard to pinpoint an exact date, but it was in 1920.
So it was pretty soon after Britain took it over.
Yes, it took place when Britain demobilized. The basic fact in the post-World War I Middle East was that when the war ended, there was a million-man British army in occupation of the Middle East and no other rival organized military force. So anything was Britain's to do. But the British public wanted the troops brought back home. And despite warnings by Churchill, that's what was done. The army was demobilized. And the uprising in Iraq and disorders elsewhere in the Middle East took place as soon as there was no policing force, no military force to prevent it. And the disorders, unrest, uprising, whatever you want to call it, in Iraq started amongst the tribesmen, and it started when the British attempted to impose taxes. And these were people that never paid taxes. Then others with discontents elsewhere in Iraq rose up too, because there wasn't anybody to keep them from doing it.
Were the British people surprised at the rebellion against the Brits in Iraq? Did they think that they were going to be very popular in Iraq because they were trying to bring them independence?
At the very first, yes, they were. At the first, they were surprised. They didn't know what was happening to them. They had no idea where the unrest was coming from. And the entire thing seemed very mysterious. Amongst British officials who were there, it looked very much as though there was some conspiracy, some underground something or another, some wicked forces who had somehow combined together to cause this unrest. On the other hand, other British officials who were no longer in office, and people like T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, were highly critical of the British administration, the people who had taken their place and were now governing the country, and said, in effect, you should have known. You British officials on the spot, it's your fault for having tried to rule in the wrong sort of way.
Iraq was a country that was created by England, and it took the provinces of Basra, Mosul, and Baghdad, put them all together, and in doing that, put together Kurds, Shiites, Sunnis, Christians, Jews, and a combination of tribes. These were not people who had identified together as members of one nation before. Do you think the idea of the nation of Iraq took immediately? How long did it take for the people of that nation to feel like they were part of a nation called Iraq?
We still don't know for sure that they do. So I suppose the answer to that question is a long time. It was put to some extent to the test during the 10-year war between Iran and Iraq some years back, when, to the surprise of many people, Iraq fought as one country. The Shiites of Iraq did not go over to the side of the Shiites of Iran, and many people were quite surprised by that. We still don't know how much of a loyalty has developed since the British put this combination together. But the little evidence that there is seems to point in the direction of saying that it's working.
I'm going to ask you a big question here. What are some of the greatest lessons of England's history, England's relationship with Iraq, that you think we can apply to what the United States is trying to accomplish in Iraq today?
The British believed that the handful of experts that they had in their government on the Middle East and these were people of great experience and knowledge about the Middle East. They believed that they knew a great deal and were, on the basis of that knowledge, in a position where they could reshape the Middle East in directions favorable to themselves. And I think the very first lesson, indeed, is that they did not know as much as they thought they knew. And for us, the lesson would be one of humility, that we ought to really question how much we know, and we ought to question our ability to remake other people in our image. We ought to seriously ask ourselves whether that is a proper endeavor for us to engage in. And that all goes into one great, sort of sense of caution about whether we really know what we're doing. One of the things that we see in the Middle East, but also elsewhere, is that, by and large, people prefer even bad government of their own to good government by foreigners. And the history of that post-World War I era in the Middle East does seem to show that the Muslim world does not want to be governed by non-Muslims.
Now, the United States says that what it wants is for the people of Iraq to be independent and to have a democracy, not to be under American rule. But do you think that the imperialist experience of the post-World War I era might lead to a certain skepticism among the people of Iraq who know their history, because the Brits at that time said, well, you know, what we want is your independence. That's what this is about. It's about Arab independence.
Yes, well, two things. First, yes, there is bound to be a good deal of skepticism in the Arab-speaking Middle East about our bona fides, and especially about our intention of letting them govern themselves and make their own decisions. It should also be said that since our government for some time now has made clear its belief that we are endangered by a certain section of fundamentalist Islam. If indeed we succeeded in installing democratic regimes throughout the Middle East, as we claim is our aim, if the people were given the vote, in other words, there's every reason to believe that we would lose that vote, that people would vote fundamentalist Muslim parties into power. So we really have a lot of questioning of ourselves to do before we instate regimes that in all likelihood will turn in our view, against us.
A lot of experts have suggested that after the end of Saddam Hussein's regime, that Iraq might become more like Lebanon or like the Balkans after the end of the Soviet Union, when there was a lot of civil war and feuding. In Iraq, you have the Kurds, the Shiites, the Sunnis. Historically, you know the history of those groups. Do you think that they might be able to work together under one government, or do you worry that there will be that kind of almost civil war between those groups?
My guess, and it's no more than a guess, is that they will be able to work together and live in relative peace with one another, so long as every group is given a large measure of autonomy.
Meaning
of self-rule.
Do you mean that, like, the Shiites have their own Kurdistan, like the Kurds have in the north of Iraq?
Something like that, yeah. The situation with the Kurds the last few years has I think, given cause for hope. It's a sort of compromise solution between, you know, various other solutions, none of which would have worked.
Are there certain obstacles you think the United States is going to face in Iraq in trying to establish a democracy there?
Yes, the first obstacle is that there are no real traditions of democracy. There's no real history of it. It isn't congenial to the local culture, as we would say. So that's certainly a problem.
What else?
Have to be sure that there was a real sense of national unity, because otherwise the democracy could result in fragmentation. Democracy is not something that you find very much in the Middle East. It's possible that it will take hold, but as I say, there's no history of it having done so.
Do you think that's a reason to not try, or?
I would seriously consider whether democracy should come first or whether it should come later, at a later stage. But it's awfully hard. This business of nation building, of trying to create recreate some other country, is a tricky one. I'm not sure that we know that we're smart enough to be able to pull it off. Great if we can, but I don't know that we can.
David Frumkin is the author of A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. He's a professor of international relations and Middle Eastern politics at Boston University.